My companions stared at me in stunned disbelief. Daydan was the first to recover, and after making his way to where I stood, surprised me with a rough, one-armed embrace. Only then did I notice one of his arms was hanging from his neck in a splint. I gave it a questioning look.
"Did you run into trouble?"
I asked, while the room buzzed chaotically around us. Daydan shook his head.
"Espa," he said simply. "She didn't take too kindly to the thought of me running off after that fairy woman. She sort of convinced me to stay."
"She broke your arm?" I remembered my parting glimpse of Hespa holding him to the ground. The big man looked down at his feet.
"A bit. She sort of held on to it while I tried to twist away."
He gave a slightly sheepish smile.
"I guess you could say we broke it together."
I clapped him on his good shoulder and laughed. "That's sweet. Truly touching." I would have continued, but the room had quieted. Everyone was watching us. Watching me. As I looked at the crowd of people, I felt suddenly disoriented. How can I explain? I've already told you I don't know how much time I spent in the Fey, but it had been a long, long while. I had lived there so long that the strangeness of it had faded. I'd grown comfortable there. Now that I was back in the mortal world, this crowded taproom seemed strange to me. How odd to be indoors rather than under the naked sky. The thick-timbered wooden benches and tables looked so primitive and rough. The lamplight seemed unnaturally bright and harsh to my eyes. I'd had no company but Felurian for ages, and the people around me seemed strange by comparison. The whites of their eyes were startling. They smelled like sweat and horses and bitter iron. Their voices were hard and sharp, their postures stiff and awkward. But that only scratches the bare surface of it. I felt out of place in my own skin. It was profoundly irritating to be wearing clothes again, and I wanted nothing more than to be comfortably naked. My boots felt like a prison. On my long walk to the Pennyworth, I'd had to constantly fight the urge to remove them. Looking at the faces around me, I saw a young woman of no more than 20. She had a sweet face and clear blue eyes. She had a perfect mouth for kissing. I took half a step towards her, fully intending to catch her up in my arms, and I stopped suddenly, just as I began to reach out with one hand to caress the side of her neck, and my head spun with something very close to vertigo. Things were different here. The man sitting beside the woman was obviously her husband. That was important, wasn't it? It seemed a very vague and distant fact. Why wasn't I already kissing this woman? Why wasn't I naked, eating violets and playing music underneath the open sky? Looking around the room again, everything seemed terribly ridiculous. These people sitting on their benches, wearing layers on layers of clothing, eating with knives and forks. It all struck me as so pointless and contrived. It was incredibly funny. It was like they were playing a game and didn't even realize it. It was like a joke I'd never understood before. And so I laughed. It wasn't loud or particularly long, but it was high and wild and full of strange delight. It was no human laugh, and it moved through the crowd like wind among the wheat. Those near enough to hear it shifted in their seats, some looking at me with curiosity, some with fear. Some shivered and refused to meet my eye. Seeing their reaction shook me, and I made an effort to get a grip on myself. I drew a deep breath and closed my eyes. The moment of strange disorientation passed, though my boots still felt hard and heavy on my feet. When I opened my eyes again, I saw Hespa looking up at me. She spoke hesitantly.
"Quoth," she said hesitantly, "you look well."
I smiled wide.
"I am."
"We thought you were lost."
"You thought I was gone," I corrected gently, as I made my way to the fireplace where Martin stood. "Dead in Felurian's arms or wandering the forest, mad and broken with desire." I looked at them each in turn. "Isn't that right?" I felt the whole room's eyes on me and decided to make the most of the situation.
Come now. I am Quoth. I am Edema Rue born. I have studied at the university and can call down lightning like Tabrilin the Great. Did you really think Felurian would be the death of me?
She would be, said a rough voice from the edge of the hearth. If you had ever so much as seen her shadow.
I turned to see the hawk-faced fiddler.
I beg your pardon, sir?
You should beg the pardon of everyone here, he said, his voice dripping with disdain. I don't know what you hope to gain from this, but I don't believe the lot of you saw Felurian. Not for a second.
I met his eyes.
I did more than see her, friend.
If that were true, then you'd be mad now, or dead. And while I'll admit you might be mad, it's not from any fairy charm.
The room chuckled at this.
No one has seen her in a score of years. The fair folk have left this place behind, and you're no Tabrilin, no matter what your friends say. I'm guessing you're just a clever storyteller hoping to make a name for himself.
That struck uncomfortably close to the mark, and I could see some of the crowd eyeing me skeptically. Before I could say anything, Daydan burst in.
What about his beard, then? When he ran off 3 nights ago, his face was smooth as a baby's arse.
So you say, the fiddler replied. I was going to keep quiet even though I didn't believe half of what you told us about those bandits or him calling the lightning, but I thought to myself, their friend probably died and they want folks to remember him with a proud story or two.
He looked down his broken nose to where Daydan sat.
But really, this has gone too far. It's not wise to tell lies about the fair folk. I don't appreciate strangers coming here and spinning my friends' heads full of nonsense. Be quiet, the lot of you. We've heard enough out of you tonight.
Having said his piece, the fiddler opened the battered case that sat next to him and drew out his instrument. The mood of the room had grown vaguely hostile by this point, and more than a few people eyed me resentfully.
Daydan sputtered angrily.
Now listen,
Hespa said something and tried to pull him down into his seat, but Daydan shook her off.
No! I won't be called a liar. We were sent here by Alvaron himself because of them bandits. And we did our job. We're not expecting a parade, but I'll be damned before I let you call me a liar. We killed those bastards. And afterward, we did see Felurian. And Quoth there did take off after her.
Daydan glared around the room belligerently, mostly in the direction of the fiddler.
That's the truth, and I swear it by my good right hand. If anyone wants to call me a liar, we can have it out right now.
The fiddler picked up his bow and met Daydan's eye. He drew a screaming note across the strings.
Liar!
Daydan nearly leapt across the room as people pushed their chairs back to make a clear space for the fight. The fiddler came to his feet slowly. He was taller than I'd expected, with short gray hair and scarred knuckles that told me he knew his way around a fistfight. I managed to get in front of Daydan and leaned against him, speaking low in his ear.
Do you really want to brawl with a broken arm? If he gets hold of it, you'll just scream and piss yourself in front of Hespa.
I felt him relax a bit and gave him a gentle push back toward his seat. He went, but he wasn't happy.
Something here, I heard a woman say behind me. If you want to have a scuff with someone, you take it outside and don't bother coming back. You don't get paid to fight the customers, you hear?
Now, Penny, the fiddler said soothingly, I was just showing some teeth to him. He's the one took it all personal. You can't blame me for making fun with the sort of stories they come in with.
I turned around and saw the fiddler explaining himself to an angry woman in her middle years. She was a full foot shorter than him and had to reach up to jab his chest with a finger. That's when I heard a voice exclaim to one side of me.
God's mother, Seb! You see that? Look at it! It's moving by itself!
You're blind drunk. It's just a breeze. There ain't no wind in tonight.
It's moving itself. Look again!
It was my shade, of course. By now, several people had noticed it blowing gently in a breeze that wasn't there. I thought the effect was rather nice, but I could tell by their wide eyes that folk were becoming alarmed. One or two slid their chairs away from me uneasily. Penny's eyes were fixed on my gently flowing shade, and she walked over to stand in front of me.
"What is it?"
she asked, her voice showing just a hint of fear. "Nothing to worry over," I said easily, holding out a fold of it for her inspection. "It is my shadow cloak. Felurian made it for me." The fiddler made a disgusted noise. Penny shot him a look and hesitantly brushed my cloak with a hand.
"It's soft,"
she murmured, looking up at me. When our eyes met, she looked surprised for a moment, then exclaimed,
"You're Losi's boy!"
Before I could ask what she meant, I heard a woman's voice say,
"What?"
I turned to see a red-haired serving girl moving toward us, the same one who had embarrassed me so badly on our first visit to the Pennyworth. Penny nodded toward me.
"It's your fresh-faced, fiery boy from about 3 span back. You remember pointing him out to me? I didn't recognize him with the beard."
Losi came to stand in front of me. Bright red curls tumbled over the bare, pale skin of her shoulders. Her dangerous green eyes swept over my shade and made their slow way up to my face.
"It's him, all right," she said sideways to Penny. "Beard or no?"
She took a step closer, almost pressing against me.
"Boys are always wearing beards and hoping it will make them men."
Her bright emerald eyes settled boldly onto mine, as if expecting me to blush and fumble about as I had before. I thought of everything I'd learned at the hands of Felurian, and felt the strange, wild laughter welling up in me again. I fought it down as best I could, but I could feel it tumbling around inside me as I met her eye and smiled. Losi took a startled half-step back, her pale skin blushing to a furious red. Penny held out a hand to steady her.
"Lord, girl, what's the matter with you?"
Losi tore her eyes away from me.
"Look at him, Penny. Really look at him. He's got a fey look about him. Look at his eyes."
Penny looked curiously at my face, then flushed a bit herself and crossed her arms in front of her chest as if I had seen her naked.
"Merciful Lord," she said breathlessly. "It's all true, then, isn't it?"
"Every word," I said.
"How did you get away from her?" Penny asked.
"Oh, come on, Penny," the fiddler cried out in disbelief. "You aren't buying this pup story, are you?"
Losi turned and spoke hotly.
"There's a look a man has when he knows his way around a woman, Ben Creighton. Not that you would know. When this one was here a couple span ago, I liked his face and thought I'd have a roll with him. But when I tried to trip him..."
She trailed off, seemingly at a loss for words.
"I remember that," a man at the bar called out. "Funniest damn thing. I thought he was going to piss himself. He couldn't say a word to her."
The fiddler shrugged.
"So he found some farmer's daughter since then. It don't mean..."
"Hush, Ben," Penny said with quiet authority. "There's more changed here than a bit of beard can account for."
Her eyes searched my face.
"Lord, but you're right, girl. There is a fey look about him."
The fiddler started to speak again, but Penny shot him a sharp look.
"Hush or get out! I don't want any fights in here tonight."
The fiddler looked around the room and saw the tide had turned against him. Red-faced and scowling, he gathered up his fiddle and stormed out. Losi stepped close to me again, brushing her hair back.
"Was she really as beautiful as they say?"
Her chin went up proudly.
"More beautiful than me?"
I hesitated, then spoke softly.
"She was Felurian, most beautiful of all."
I reached out to brush the side of her neck where her red hair began its curling tumble downward, then leaned forward and whispered 7 words into her ear.
"For all that, she lacked your fire."
And she loved me for those 7 words, and her pride was safe.
Penny spoke up.
How did you manage to get away?
I looked around the room and felt everyone's attention settle onto me. The wild, fey laughter tumbled around inside me. I smiled a lazy smile. My shade billowed. Then I moved to the front of the room, sat on the hearth, and told them the story. Or rather, I told them a story. If I told them the entire truth, they wouldn't have believed it. Felurian let me go because I was holding a song hostage? It simply didn't fit the classic lines. So what I told them was closer to the story they expected to hear. In that story, I chased Felurian into the Fae, our bodies tangled together in her twilight glade. Then, as we rested, I played her music light enough to make her laugh, music dark enough to make her gasp, music sweet enough to make her weep. But when I tried to leave the Fae, she would not let me. She was too fond of my artistry. I shouldn't be coy, I suppose. I implied rather strongly that Felurian thought quite highly of me as a lover. I offer no apology for this behavior except to say that I was a young man of 16, proud of my newfound skills, and not above a little bragging. I told them how Felurian had tried to trap me in the Fae, how we fought with magic. For this, I borrowed a little from Taberlin the Great. There was fire and lightning. At the end, I bested Felurian, but spared her life. In her gratitude, she wove me a fairy cloak, taught me secret magics, and gave me a silver leaf as a token of her favor. The leaf was pure fabrication, of course, but it wouldn't have been a proper story if she hadn't given me three gifts. All in all, it was a good story, and if it wasn't entirely true, well, at least it had some truth mixed in. In my defense, I could have dispensed with the truth entirely and told a much better story. Lies are simpler, and most of the time, they make better sense. Losi watched me all through the telling, and seemed to take the whole thing as something of a challenge to the prowess of mortal women. After the story was over, she laid claim to me and led me to a small room on the topmost floor of the Pennyworth. I managed very little sleep that night, and Losi came closer to killing me than Felurian ever had. She was a delightful partner, every bit as wonderful as Felurian had been. But how could that be, I hear you ask? How could any mortal woman compare with Felurian? It's easier to understand if you think of it in terms of music. Sometimes a man enjoys a symphony. Else times he finds a jig more suited to his taste. The same holds true for lovemaking. One type is suited to the deep cushions of a twilight forest glade. Another comes quite naturally tangled in the sheets of narrow beds upstairs in inns. Each woman is like an instrument, waiting to be learned, loved, and finally played, to have at last her own true music made. Some might take offense at this way of seeing things, not understanding how a trooper views his music. They might think I degrade women. They might consider me callous or boorish or crude. But those people do not understand love or music or me. Chapter 108. Quick. We spent a few days at the Pennyworth while our welcome was warm. We had our own rooms and all our meals for free. Fewer bandits meant safer roads and more customers, and Penny knew our presence at the inn would draw a better crowd than fiddle playing any night. We put the time to good use, enjoying hot meals and soft beds. All of us could use the time to mend. Hespa was still nursing her arrow-shot leg, Daydan his broken arm. My own minor injuries from the fight with the bandits were long since gone, but I had newer ones, mostly consisting of a heavily scratched back. I taught Tempe the basics of the lute, and he resumed teaching me how to fight. My training consisted of short, terse discussions concerning the Lethani and long, strenuous periods of practicing the Catan. I also pieced together a song about my Felurian experience. I originally called it In Twilight Versed, which, you have to admit, wasn't a very good title. Luckily, the name didn't stick, and these days, most folk know it as The Song Half-Sung. It wasn't my best work, but it was easy to remember. The customers at the inn seemed to enjoy it, and when I heard Losi whistling it as she served drinks, I knew it would spread like a fire in a seam of coal. Since folk kept asking for stories, I shared a few other interesting events from my life. I told them how I'd managed to get admitted into the university when I was barely 15 years old. I told them how I'd gained entry to the Arcanum in a mere 3 days' time. I told them how I had called the name of the wind in a furious rage after Ambrose broke my lute. Unfortunately, by the third night, I was out of true stories, and, since my audience was still hungry for more, I simply stole a story about Ilion and put myself in his place instead, stealing a few pieces from Taberlin while I was at it. I'm not proud of that, and in my defense I'd like to say I'd had quite a bit to drink. What's more, there were a few pretty women in my audience. There is something powerfully beguiling about the excited eyes of a young woman. They can pull all manner of nonsense out of a foolish young man, and I was no exception to this rule. Meanwhile, Daedan and Hespa occupied the small, exclusive world new lovers make for themselves. They were a delight to watch. Daedan was gentler, quieter. Hespa's face lost much of its hardness. They spent a great deal of time in their room, catching up on their sleep, no doubt. Martin flirted outrageously with Penny, drank enough to drown a fish, and generally enjoyed himself enough for any three men. We left the Pennysworth after 3 days, not wanting to wear our welcome thin. I, for one, was glad to go. Between Tempe's training and Losi's attentions, I was nearly dead from exhaustion. We made slow time on the road back to Severin. Part of this was out of concern for Hespa's injured leg, but some of it was because we knew our time together was drawing to an end. Despite our difficulties, we had become close, and it is hard to leave such things behind. News of our adventures had run ahead of us on the road, so when we stopped for the night, our meals and beds were easy to come by, if not free. On our third day out of the Pennysworth, we ran across a small troupe of performers. They weren't a Demaru and looked rather out at the heels. There were just four of them, an older fellow, two men in their 20s, and a boy of 8 or 9. They were packing up their rickety cart just as we were stopping to give Hespa's leg a bit of a rest. "Hello, the troopers!" I called out. They looked up nervously, then relaxed as they saw the lute across my back.
"Hello, the bard!"
I laughed and shook their hands. "No bard here, just a bit of a singer."
"Hello the same," the older man said, smiling. "Which way are you heading?"
"North to south. Yourself?" They relaxed further once they knew I was heading in a different direction.
"East to west," he said.
"How's your luck been?"
He shrugged. "Poor enough lately, but we've heard tell of a Lady Chalker who lives 2 days off. They say she never turns a man away if he can fiddle a bit or mum a play. We hope to come off with a penny or two."
"Things were better when we had the bear," one of the younger men said. "Folk'll pay to see a bear bait."
"Went sick of a dog bite," the other man complained to me.
"Died near a year ago."
"That's a shame," I said. "Bears hard to come by." They nodded a silent agreement. "I've got a new song for you. What will you trade me for it?" He eyed me warily.
"Well now, new to you isn't exactly new to us," he pointed out. "And a new song ain't necessarily a good song, if you know what I mean."
"Judge for yourself," I said, as I uncased my lute. I'd written it to be easy to remember and simple to sing, but I still had to repeat it twice before he caught all of it. As I've said, they weren't a Demaru.
"A good enough song," he admitted grudgingly. "Everyone likes Falurian, but I don't know what we can trade you for it."
The young boy piped up.
"I made up a verse to Tinker Tanner."
The others tried to hush him, but I smiled. "I'd love to hear it." The boy puffed himself up and sang out in a piping voice.
"I once saw a fair farmer's daughter on the riverbank far from all men. She was taking a bath when I saw her. She said she didn't feel right if a man caught a sight, so she soaped herself slowly all over again."
I laughed. That's good, I complimented him. But how about this? I once saw a fair farmer's daughter on the riverbank far from all men. She confessed to me once when I caught her that she didn't feel clean if her bathing was seen, so she washed herself over again. The boy thought about it.
I like mine better,
he said after a moment's consideration. I patted him on the back. It's a good man that sticks to his own verse. I turned back to the leader of the little troop. Any gossip? He thought for a moment.
Bandits north of here in the Eld.
I nodded.
They've been cleared out now, so I've heard.
He thought some more.
I heard Elveron's getting married to the Lackless woman.
I know a poem about Lackless.
The young boy chimed in again and began.
Seven things stand before the entrance to the Lackless door.
Hush!
The older man cuffed the boy gently alongside of his head. He looked up apologetically.
Boy's got a good ear, but not one lick of manners.
Actually, I said, I'd like to hear it. He shrugged and let go of the boy, who glared at him before reciting.
Seven things stand before the entrance to the Lackless door. One of them a ring unworn, one a word that is forsworn, one a time that must be right, one a candle without light, one a sun who brings the blood, one a door that holds the flood, one a thing tight held in keeping, then comes that which comes with sleeping.
It's one of those riddle rhymes, the father said apologetically. Lord knows where he hears them, but he knows better than to go spouting every lewd thing he hears. Where did you hear it? I asked. The boy thought for a moment, then shrugged and began to scratch himself behind his knee.
You know, kids.
We should be getting on,
the older man said, looking up at the sky. I dug into my purse and handed him a silver noble.
What's this, then?
He asked, eyeing it suspiciously.
To help with a new bear, I said. I've been through some tight times, too. But I'm flush now. They left after thanking me profuse. Poor fellows. No self-respecting Rue troop would ever stoop to bear baiting. There was no skill involved, no pride in the performance. But they could hardly be blamed for their lack of Rue blood, and we troopers have to watch out for each other. No one else does.
Tempe and I used our walking hours to discuss the Lethani and evenings to practice the K-10. It was becoming easier for me, and I could sometimes make it as far as catching rain before Tempe caught some minuscule mistake and made me start over. The two of us had found a halfway secluded place beside the inn where we had stopped for the day. Daydan, Hespa, and Martin were inside drinking. I worked my way carefully through the K-10 while Tempe sat with his back to a tree practicing a basic fingering drill I had taught him with relentless determination. Over and over. Over and over. I had just made it through circling hands when I caught a flicker of movement from the corner of my eye. I did not pause, as Tempe had taught me to avoid distraction while performing the K-10. If I turned to look, I would have to start over again. Moving with painful slowness, I began dance backwards. But as soon as I placed my heel, I could tell my balance was wrong. I waited for Tempe to call out, but he didn't. I stopped the K-10 and turned to see a group of four Adem mercenaries walking toward us with a prowling grace. Tempe was already on his feet and walking toward them. My lute was back in its case and leaning up against the side of the tree. Soon, the five of them were standing in a tight group, close enough that their shoulders almost touched. Close enough that I couldn't hear the barest whisper of what they were saying or even see their hands. But I could tell from the angle of Tempe's shoulders that he was uncomfortable, defensive. I knew calling out to Tempe would be considered rude, so I walked over. But before I came close enough to hear, one of the unfamiliar mercenaries stretched out a hand and pushed me away, his spread fingers pressing firmly against the center of my chest. Without thinking, I made break lion, taking hold of his thumb and turning his wrist away from me. He loosened his hand from mine without any apparent effort and moved to trip me with chasing stone.
I made dance backwards and got the balance right this time, but his other hand struck me in the temple just enough to dizzy me for half a second, not hard enough to even hurt. My pride stung, though. It was the same way Tempe struck me in silent rebuke for sloppy performance of the K-10.
"Quick," the mercenary said softly in Aeturin. It was only when I heard her voice that I realized she was a woman. Not that she was particularly masculine, it was simply that she seemed so similar to Tempe. She had the same sandy hair, pale gray eyes, calm expression, blood-red clothes. She was taller than Tempe by a few inches, and her shoulders were broader than his. But while she was whipcord thin, the tightness of her mercenary reds still revealed the lean curves of hip and breast. Looking more closely, I could easily see three of the four mercenaries were women. The broad-shouldered one facing me had a thin scar cutting through her eyebrow and another close to her jaw. They were the same pale silver scars Tempe had on his arms and chest. And while they were far from gruesome, they made her expressionless face look oddly grim.
"Quick," she had said. On the surface, it seemed to be a compliment. But I've been mocked enough in my life to recognize it, regardless of the language. Even worse, her right hand slid all the way around to rest in the small of her back, palm facing out. Even with my rudimentary knowledge of Adam hand talk, I knew what that meant. Her hand was as far as it could possibly get from the hilt of her sword. At the same time, she turned her shoulder to me and looked away. I wasn't just being declared unthreatening. This was insultingly dismissive. I fought to keep my face calm, guessing any expression would only further lower her opinion of me. Tempe pointed back where I had come from. "Go," he said, serious, formal. I reluctantly obeyed, not wanting to make a scene. The Adem stood in a close knot a quarter hour as I practiced the K-10. Though I didn't hear a whisper of their conversation, it was obvious they were arguing. Their gestures were sharp and angry, the placement of their feet aggressive. Eventually, the four unfamiliar Adem left, walking back toward the road. Tempe returned to where I was trying to work my way through threshing wheat.
"Tuvide."
Irritation. He tapped my back leg and pushed my shoulder to show my balance was lacking. I moved my foot and tried again.
"Who were they, Tempe?"
"Adem,"
he said simply, sitting himself back down at the foot of the tree.
"Did you know them?"
"Yes."
Tempe looked around, then brought my loot out of its case. With his hands occupied, he was doubly mute. I went back to practicing the K-10, knowing that trying to pry answers out of him would be like pulling teeth. 2 hours passed, and the sun began to sink behind the western trees.
"Tomorrow, I leave," he said.
With both his hands still on the lute, I could only guess at his mood.
"Where?"
"To Heard. To Cheyenne."
"Are those cities?"
"Heard is city. Cheyenne is my teacher."
I had given some thought to what might be the matter.
"Are you in trouble for teaching me?"
He set the lute back in the case and pressed the lid back in place.
"Perhaps."
"Yes."
"Is it forbidden?"
"It is most forbidden," he said.
Tempe stood and began the K-10. I followed him, and both of us were quiet for a while.
"How much trouble?" I asked eventually.
"Most trouble," he said.
And I heard an uncharacteristic shred of emotion in his voice. Anxiety.
"It was perhaps unwise."
Together, we moved as slowly as the setting sun. I thought of what the Cathay had said. The one shred of potentially useful information it had let slip in our conversation.
"You laughed at fairies until you saw one. Small wonder all your civilized neighbors dismissed the Chandrian as well.
You'd have to leave your precious corners far behind before you found someone who might take you seriously. You wouldn't have a hope until you made it to the storm wall.
Valorian had said the Cathay only spoke the truth. "Could I accompany you?" I asked.
"Accompany?"
Tempi asked, his hands moving in a graceful circle intended to break the long bones of the arm. "Travel with. Follow. To Hert."
"Yes."
"Would it help your trouble?"
"Yes."
"I will come."
"I thank you."
Chapter 109 Barbarians and Madmen. Truthfully, I wanted nothing more than to make my way back to Severin. I wanted to sleep in a bed again and take advantage of the mayor's favor while it was still fresh in his mind. I wanted to find Denna and make things right between us. But Tempi was in trouble for teaching me. I couldn't simply run off and leave him to face that by himself. What's more, the Cathay had told me Denna had already left Severin behind, though I hardly needed a prophetic fairy to tell me that. I'd been gone for a month, and Denna was never the sort to let grass grow under her feet. So the next morning, our group parted ways. Daydan, Hespa, and Martin were going south to Severin to report to the mayor and collect their pay. Tempi and I were heading northeast toward the Stormwall and Ademre.
"You sure you don't want me to take him the box?"
Daydan asked for the fifth time. "I promised the mayor I'd return any monies to him personally," I lied. "But I do need you to give him this." I handed the big mercenary the letter I'd written the night before. "It explains why I had to make you the leader of the group," I grinned. "You might get a bonus out of it." Daydan puffed up importantly as he took hold of the letter. Standing nearby, Martin made a noise that could have been a cough. As Tempi and I traveled, I managed to coax a few details from the mercenary. Eventually, I learned it was customary for someone of his social standing to gain permission before he took a student of his own. Complicating matters was the fact that I was an outsider, a barbarian. In teaching a person like me, it seems like Tempi had done more than violate a custom. He had broken a trust with his teacher and his people.
"Will there be a trial of some sort?" I asked.
He shook his head.
"No trial. Cheyenne will ask me questions. I will say, I saw in Quoth good iron waiting. He is of Lethani. He needs Lethani to guide him."
Tempi nodded at me.
"Cheyenne will ask you of the Lethani, to see if I were right in my seeing. Cheyenne will decide if you are iron worth striking."
His hand circled, making the gesture for uneasy. "And what will happen if I am not?" I asked.
"For you?"
Uncertainty.
"For me, I will be cut away."
"Cut away?" I asked, hoping I misunderstood. He held up a hand and wiggled his fingers.
"Adem."
He made a tight fist and shook it.
"Ademre."
Then he opened his hand and touched his little finger.
"Tempi."
He touched the other fingers.
"Friend, brother, mother."
He touched the thumb.
"Cheyenne."
Then he made a gesture as if paring off his little finger and throwing it away.
"Cut away,"
he said. Not killed then, but exiled. I started to breathe easier until I looked in Tempi's pale eyes. For just a moment, there was a crack in his perfect, placid mask, and behind it I saw the truth. Death would be a kinder punishment than being cut away. He was terrified, as frightened as anyone I had ever seen. We agreed our best hope was for me to put myself entirely in Tempi's hands during the trip to Hert. I had approximately 15 days to polish what I knew to a bright shine. The hope being that when I met Tempi's superiors, I could make a good impression. Before we began that first day, Tempe instructed me to put my shade away. Reluctantly, I did so. It folded down into a surprisingly small bundle that stowed easily into my travel sack. The pace Tempe set was grueling. First, the two of us moved through the dancer's stretch I had watched many times before. Then, instead of our usual brisk walk, we ran for an hour. Then, we performed the K-10 with Tempe correcting my endless mistakes. Then, we walked a mile. Finally, we sat and discussed the Lathani. The fact that these discussions were in Ademic did not make matters easier, but we agreed I should immerse myself in the language so when I reached Hert, I could speak as a civilized person.
"What is the purpose of the Lathani?" Tempe asked.
"To give us a path to follow," I replied.
"No," Tempe said sternly. "The Lathani is not a path."
"What is the purpose of the Lathani, Tempe?"
"To guide us in our actions. By following the Lathani, you act rightly."
"Is this not a path?"
"No. The Lathani is what helps us choose a path."
Then we would begin the cycle again. Run an hour, perform the K-10, walk a mile, discuss the Lathani. It took about 2 hours, and after our brief discussion was finished, we began again. At one point in our discussion of the Lathani, I began to make the gesture for understatement. But Tempe lay his hand on top of mine, stopping me.
"When we are having talk about the Lathani, you are to make none of this."
His left hand moved quickly through excitement, negation, and several other gestures I didn't recognize.
"Why?"
Tempe thought for a moment.
"When you speak of Lathani, it should not come from here."
He tapped on my head. "Or here." He tapped on my chest over my heart and ran his fingers down to my left hand.
"True knowing of the Lathani lives deeper, lives here."
He prodded me in the stomach below my navel.
"You must speak from here without thinking."
As we continued, I slowly came to understand the unspoken rules to our discussions. Not only was it intended to teach me the Lathani, it was supposed to reveal how deeply rooted understanding of the Lathani had become within me. That meant questions were to be answered quickly, with none of the deliberate pauses that usually marked Ademic conversation. You were not supposed to give a thoughtful answer. You were supposed to give an earnest one. If you truly understood the Lathani, that knowledge would become obvious in your answers. Run, K-10, walk, discuss. We completed the cycle 3 times before our midday break. 6 hours. I was covered in sweat and half convinced I would die. After an hour to rest and eat, we were off again. We finished another 3 cycles before we stopped for the night. We made camp by the side of the road. I chewed my supper half asleep, spread my blanket, and wrapped myself in my shade. In my exhausted state, it seemed soft and warm as a down eider. In the middle of the night, Tempe shook me awake. Though some deep animal part of me hated him, I knew it was necessary as soon as I stirred. My body was stiff and aching, but the slow, familiar movements of the K-10 helped loosen my tight muscles. He made me stretch and drink water. Then I slept like a stone for the remainder of the night. The second day was worse. Even strapped tightly to my back, my lute became a miserable burden. The sword I couldn't even use dragged at my hip. My travel sack felt heavy as a millstone, and I regretted not letting Daydan take the mayor's box. My muscles were rubbery and disloyal, and when we ran, my breath burned in my throat. The moments when Tempe and I spoke of Lathani were the only real rest, but they were disappointingly brief. My mind spun with exhaustion, and it took all my concentration to pull my thoughts into order, trying to give proper answers. Even so, my responses only irritated him. Time after time he shook his head, explaining how I was wrong. Eventually, I gave up trying to be right. Too weary to care, I quit pulling my exhausted thoughts into order and simply enjoyed sitting down for a few minutes. I was too wary to remember what I said half the time, but surprisingly, Tempe found those answers more to his liking.
That was a blessing. When my answers pleased him, our discussions lasted longer, and I could spend more time resting. I felt considerably better the third day. My muscles no longer ached as badly. My breath came easier. My head felt clear and light, like a leaf floating on the wind. In this frame of mind, answers to Tempe's questions tripped easily off the tip of my tongue, simple as singing. Run, Katan, walk, discuss. Three cycles. Then, as we moved through the Katan on the side of the road, I collapsed. Tempe had been watching closely and caught me before I hit the ground. My world spun dizzily for a few minutes before I realized I was in the shade of a tree at the side of the road. Tempe must have carried me there. He held out my water skin. Drink. The thought of water was not appealing, but I took a mouthful anyway.
I am sorry, Tempe.
He shook his head.
You came far before falling. You did not complain. You showed your mind is stronger than your body. That is good. When the mind controls the body, that is of the Lethani. But knowing your limit is also of the Lethani. It is better to stop when you must than run until you fall.
Unless falling is what the Lethani requires, I said without thinking. My head still felt light as a windblown leaf.
He gave me a rare smile.
Yes, you are beginning to see.
I returned his smile.
Your return is coming very well, Tempe.
Tempe blinked.
Worry. We are speaking my language, not yours.
I'm not speaking...
I started to protest, but as I did, I listened to the words I was using.
Skeopateus.
My head reeled for a moment.
Drink again, Tempe said, and though his face and voice were carefully controlled, I could tell he was concerned.
I took another sip to pacify him. Then, as if my body suddenly realized it needed the water, I became very thirsty and took several large swallows. I stopped before I drank too much and cramped my stomach. Tempe nodded, approval.
Am I speaking well, then?
I said to distract myself from my thirst.
You are speaking well for a child. Very well for a barbarian.
Only well? Am I making the words wrong?
You touch eyes too much.
He widened his eyes and stared pointedly into my own, unblinking.
Also, your words are good but simple.
You must teach me more words then.
He shook his head, serious.
You already know too many words.
Too many? Tempe, I know very few.
It is not the words, it is their use. In Adem there is an art to speaking. There are those who can say many things in one thing. My Cheyenne is such. They say a thing in one breath, and others will find meaning in it for a year.
Gentle reproach.
Too often you say more than you need. You should not speak in Adamic as you sing in Aturan. 100 words to praise a woman. Too many. Our talk is smaller.
So when I meet a woman, I should simply say, you are beautiful?
Tempe shook his head.
No. You would say simply beautiful and let the woman decide the rest of what you mean.
Isn't that...
I didn't know the words for vague or unspecific and had to start again to get my point across.
Doesn't that lead to confusion?
It leads to thoughtfulness, he said firmly. It is delicate. That should always be the concern when one is speaking. To be too much talking.
He shook his head, disapproval.
It is...
He stalled, searching for a word.
Rude?
Negation. Frustration.
I go to Severin, and there are people who think. There are people who do not. Both are people, but those who do not stink are people of quality.
He tapped my chest firmly with two fingers.
You are not a goat herd. You are a student of the Lethani. my student, you should speak as a person of quality.
But what about clarity? What if you were building a bridge? There are many pieces to that. All of them must be said clearly.
Of course, Tempi said, agreement. Sometimes. But in most things, important things, delicate is better. Small is better.
Tempi reached out and gripped my shoulder firmly. Then he looked up, met my eye, and held it for a brief moment. Such a rarity for him. He gave a small, quiet smile.
Proud, he said.
The remainder of the day was spent in recovery. We would walk a few miles, perform the K-10, discuss the Lethani, then walk again. We stopped at a roadside inn that evening where I ate enough for 3 men and fell into bed before the sun had left the sky. The next day, we went back to the cycles, but only 2 before midday and 2 after. My body burned and ached, but I was no longer delirious with exhaustion. Fortunately, with a little mental effort, I could slide back into that strange, anticipatory clear-headedness I'd used to answer Tempi's questions the day before. Over the next couple of days, I came to think of that odd mental state as spinning leaf. It seemed like a distant cousin to Heart of Stone, the mental exercise I'd learned so long ago. That said, there was little similarity between the two. Heart of Stone was practical. It stripped away emotion and focused my mind. It made it easier to break my mind into separate pieces or maintain the all-important Alar. On the other hand, spinning leaf seemed largely useless. It was relaxing to let my mind grow clear and empty, then float and tumble lightly from one thing to the next. But aside from helping me draw answers to Tempi's questions out of thin air, it seemed to have no practical value. It was the mental equivalent of a card trick. By the 8th day on the road, my body no longer ached constantly. That was when Tempi added something new. After performing the K-10, the 2 of us would fight. It was hard, as that was when I was the most weary. But after the fighting, we would always sit, rest, and discuss the Lethani.
"Why did you smile as we fought today?" Tempi would say.
"Because I was happy."
"Did you enjoy the fighting?"
"Yes." Tempi radiated displeasure.
"That is not of the Lethani."
I thought for a moment on my next question. Should a man take pleasure in the fight?
No. You take pleasure in acting rightly and following the Lethani.
What if following the Lethani requires me to fight? Should I not take pleasure in it?
No. You should take pleasure in following the Lethani. If you fight well, you should take pride in doing a thing well. For the fighting itself, you should feel only duty and sorrow. Only barbarians and madmen take pleasure in combat. Whoever loves the fight itself has left the Lethani behind.
On the 11th day, Tempi showed me how to incorporate my sword into the K-10. The first thing I learned was how quickly a sword becomes lead-heavy when held at arm's length. With our sparring and the addition of the sword, each cycle took nearly 2.5 hours. Still, we kept to our schedule every day. 3 cycles before noon, 3 cycles after. 15 hours in all. I could feel my body hardening, becoming quick and lean like Tempi's. So we ran, and I learned, and Hert drew ever closer.
Chapter 110 Beauty and Branch. As we traveled, we moved quickly through towns, stopping only for food and water. The countryside was a blur. My mind was focused on the K-10, the Lethani, and the language I was learning. The road became narrower as we made our way into the foothills of the storm wall. The land grew rocky and jagged, and the road began to snake back and forth as it avoided box valleys, bluffs, and jumbles of broken rock. The air changed, growing cooler than I expected in summer. We finished the trip in 15 days. At my best guess, we covered almost 300 miles in that time. Hert was the first Adem town I'd ever seen, and to my inexperienced eye, it hardly seemed a town at all.
There was no central street lined with houses and shops. What buildings I did see were widely spaced, oddly shaped, and built to fit closely with the natural shape of the land, as if they were trying to keep out of sight. I didn't know that the powerful storms that gave the mountain range its name were common here. Their sudden, changing winds would tear apart anything so upthrust and angular as the square timber houses common in the lands below. Instead, the Adem built sensibly, hiding their buildings from the weather. Homes were built into the sides of hills, or outward from the leeward walls of sheltering cliffs. Some were dug downward. Others were carved into the stony sides of bluffs. Some you could hardly see unless you were standing next to them. The exception was a group of low stone buildings clustered close together some distance from the road. We stopped outside the largest of these. Tempe turned to face me, tugging nervously at the leather straps holding his mercenary reds tight to his arms.
I must go and make my introductions to Cheyenne. It may be some time.
Anxiety, regret.
You must wait here, perhaps long.
His body language told me more than his words. I cannot take you inside, as you are a barbarian. I will wait, I reassured him. He nodded and went inside, glancing back at me before closing the door behind himself. I looked around, watching a few people quietly going about their business. A woman carrying a basket, a young boy leading a goat by a piece of rope. The buildings were made of the same rough stone as the landscape, blending into their surroundings. The sky was overcast, adding another shade of gray. The wind blew over everything, snapping around corners and making patterns in the grass. I thought briefly of pulling on my shade, but decided against it. The air was thinner here and cooler, but it was still summer, and the sun was warm. It felt oddly peaceful here, with none of the clamor and stink of a larger town. No clatter of hooves on cobblestones. No cart vendors singing out their wares. I could imagine someone like Tempe growing up in a place like this, soaking in the quiet until he was full of it, then taking it with him when he left. With little else to look at, I turned to the nearby building. It was made from uneven pieces of stone pieced together like a jigsaw. Looking closer, I was puzzled by the lack of mortar. I tapped it with a knuckle, wondering briefly if it might be a single piece of stone carved to look like many stones fit together. Behind me, I heard a voice say in Ademic,
"What do you think of our wall?"
I turned to see an older woman with the characteristic pale gray eyes of the Adem. Her face was impassive, but her features were kind and motherly. She wore a yellow woolen cap pulled down over her ears. It was roughly knitted, and the sandy hair that stuck out from underneath was starting to go white. After all this time traveling with Tempe, it was odd to see an Adem who wasn't strapped into tight mercenary reds and wearing a sword. This woman wore a loose-fitting white shirt and linen pants.
"Is it fascinating, our wool?"
she asked, gesturing gentle amusement, curiosity, with one hand.
"What do you think of it?"
"I think it is beautiful," I responded in Ademic, careful to make only brief eye contact. Her hand tilted in an unfamiliar gesture.
"Beautiful?"
I gave the barest of shrugs.
"There is beauty that belongs to simple things of function." "Perhaps you are mistaking a word," she said.
Gentle apology.
"Beauty is a flower, or a woman, or a gem. Perhaps you mean to say utility. Of all is useful."
"Useful, but beautiful as well."
"Perhaps a thing gains beauty being used."
"Perhaps a thing is used according to its beauty," I countered, wondering if this was the Adem equivalent of small talk. If it was, I preferred it to the insipid gossip of the mayor's court.
"What of my hat?"
she asked, touching it with a hand.
"Is it beautiful because it is used?"
It was knitted from a thick homespun wool and dyed a bright corn silk yellow.
It was slightly lopsided, and its stitching was uneven in places.
"It seems very warm," I said carefully.
She gestured, small amusement, and her eyes twinkled ever so slightly.
"It is that," she said.